First of all, this is really exciting to me that you guys are all here, because this is a packed room.
Wow.
Which is rad. Hi, Zach. Okay, awesome. Thank you guys for being excited about being here. There are several faces that I haven't seen in a long time, and so that's precious. That's an awesome work of the Lord. I know we've been praying for tonight, and so I'm confident that he has every single one of you in this room on purpose. And Lisa, thank you for coming.
Yeah.
I know it's your heart to want to share and to want to have and take every opportunity to give God glory, no matter what the story. Huh?
Yep.
Yeah. So Lisa has something she wants to share first. So instead of the normal where we just start off with questions and who were you at 5 years old or whatever, she wants to go ahead and start with something that God put on her heart, and then we'll start with the questions.
Yes, thanks. Yeah, and I need to kind of give you a little update on it and why I asked her to do this. One of the things, and we'll be able to talk about it tonight after, you know, when we're done interviewing and Q&A, but I have not arrived. And so it's a journey that I'm on still. And at this particular part of my journey, I am going through a grieving process that I've never gone through before. And so I find myself just completely bursting into tears in the middle of the night. And so that's kind of where I've been for the last few days. And I was thinking about stuff this morning, and I thought about, how am I going to do this when I can't just like think about how pretty it is outside without bawling? I have been meaning to write a letter to an individual for a really long time, and so I took the time this morning to start writing the letter, and it just kept coming and it just kept coming, and so I want to read the letter to you because it'll keep me on track and it'll keep me focused so I won't bunny trail and go off somewhere where I don't need to go, and then it'll really give you guys a good opportunity to understand where I was at and then where I'm at now. And then we can do a lot of Q&A afterwards. So I am a horse fanatic. I absolutely love horses. And I was introduced to a documentary about a guy named Buck. And Buck is like the original horse whisperer. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. But this guy can do incredible things with horses. He can get the most wild, crazy horse to do whatever he wants it to do without touching it. He has just this sense of gentleness, and he brings peace upon these animals like you wouldn't believe, and it's just phenomenal to watch a story. And so when I watched the documentary, it completely undid me, and I've watched it 4 times, and I watched it again the other day, and my kids are asking why I keep asking, or keep watching, but I was compelled to just write him and thank him for sharing his story, because his story was a catalyst for me. And so I wrote him a letter. Don't know if I'll send it, but this is what I wrote. Just so you guys can understand, one of the horses in the documentary is a predator. It's actually one of the most dangerous animals he'd ever seen. And so I'm going to refer to that horse in this letter. Okay. So, dear Buck, I watched your documentary for the 4th time the other day. And it's not going to be the last. I'm changed in a new way, and I'm inspired with every opportunity I have to see something that I didn't see before. Sometimes the sobs from the darkest pain drown out some of the wisdom, and then there's times my mind gets stuck on a story that you've told, and I need to think on it a while. I'm never bored, and I never skip a scene. I drink, and I learn. My name is Lisa, and I'm 42. I'm married, and I have 3 sons and a daughter-in-law. My passion for horses has haunted me since I was 4, when the abuse began. I use the word haunted because my love affair with horses has always eluded me. We've never had money to care for them. When I had land to board them, the 3 I took care of were wild and unapproachable, but they were a sight to behold, and I was able to appreciate them regardless. I've not given up my dream to have my own one day, but I myself have been I have been wild and unapproachable, so it's all in good time. I share these intimate details with you because I trust I'm in good company, which is why I'm sharing it with you. Also to express gratitude. I hope to encourage you and your family because your story was the catalyst for my journey to freedom. Truth be told, I am afraid of horses. They know me better than I know myself. I used to pride myself on being transparent and real, but I had a rude awakening. I was just real angry. I knew how to hold it together, and I truly have been happy at times and as genuine as I was capable of being. People are always telling me I'm beautiful, so for whatever reason, that makes me seem approachable, and sometimes it's the only reason why people pursue me. But a horse knows me. The first time I watched the documentary, I was with my mom and my youngest son. I cried a little, and I oohed and aahed at the way that you handled those horses. I took a deep breath as the credits rolled, and I exhaled the words, "What a great story." And then I watched it one night, a few weeks later, with my husband. Oh dear, a deep pain erupted. Sobs with no sound, for fear a neighbor would think that I'd witnessed a murder. No amount of Kleenex could sop up the salt water and the snot pouring uncontrollably. And my poor husband could only sit and watch. It was the predator horse. I had the crazy thought that I could beg with him not to kick. No, please, don't fight them. Dear God, don't bite him. Don't you know what they're going to do? They're going to kill you. But it didn't work, and he bit Dan and was gently loaded into his trailer to be put to his death. They said it's for his own good. He's too dangerous. People need to be protected from him. There's no hope in restoring him. Well, I was the predator horse. The abuse started when I was 4, but I didn't know about it until I was 25. The brutal undoing and theft of a child's sexual purity and innocence, more often than not, leaves no visible marks. The magnificent brain shifts gears to help the mind survive trauma, and mine protected me by memory loss. I have to take a deep breath and believe that it's the best thing for me to not remember, but I still struggle and cry foul. A piece of my mind has been stolen, cruel thief, and I want it back. It haunts me to know those men hold that peace. Where is the justice? But then who am I to serve it? No visible marks. In fact, I was perfect. Straight A's, top athlete, concert pianist, student body president. Shall I continue? It was a facade. It's easy to be on top when your competition is just a few hundred kids in elementary school. But what about junior high? I don't know how else to articulate it, but at 12, I was fully aware that I could not maintain my current status as the best. So all bets were off. Nothing mattered anymore, especially not me. I did not matter. I sold myself for free. I was the ugliest, most terrifyingly beautiful mess. No one knew what to do with me, least of all myself. So I would choose who I'd let abuse me, and when they were done, I would try to hurt them back. This unruly behavior had to stop. I was a threat to myself and to others. So I was gently loaded onto a plane and sent to my death, or so it seemed. The counseling begins. Do you know why you're here? Yeah, my behavior is unacceptable. I'm self-destructing and I can't stop. Well, why are you behaving this way? I don't know. Were you physically abused? No. Was there sexual abuse? No. Well, you're going to be here for at least a year, so if you want to go home, some changes are going to need to be made. I faked it. I can fake it for a year if that's what they want. Look good, get good grades, apologize for my bad behavior, express a desire to change, engage in counseling, let them break me, so that they think that I'm ready for training, change my behavior. The sad thing was, I didn't want to continue killing myself. I just didn't know how to stop. Submission to authority felt more like giving up and opening myself up to more abuse. Faking it gave me some sense that I was at least in control of who my abusers would be. I chose an abusive man to marry. I chose to believe that was what I deserved. The abusive man left me with my 2 sons at 4 years old and 7 days old. But they were my inspiration to live, so I tucked on my bootstraps and vowed to dedicate my life to my boys. Then along came Michael, a man that I didn't believe that I deserved, but I graciously accepted his invitation to spend the rest of our lives together. For these 15 years, I have tried desperately to not behave like the predator horse. I have to keep it together. I have too much to lose. This is a journal entry from November 8th, 2012, titled Put Down. My fear, my greatest fear, is I am so wild I'll be put down because it's the humane thing to do. Like the horse, so out of control and so misunderstood, needing assurance and time and help and love. But he was too much and he was too dangerous. The pain of performance has trained me to always be ready for a show. I can only be myself while I'm in hiding. But I'm always afraid that someone will see the real me and then point out that there is something deeply wrong with who I am. I relate to those show horses, head down in painful submission, so much work to be beautiful. There can't be any flaws because flaws are not acceptable. Flaws are noticed and then shameful words are spewed. No one even knows or wants to know the real person. Journal entry November 11th, 2012, titled, I Need Buck. So don't let that freak you out. What I meant in that expression was, it was figurative. Since I was relating to the horses, it became tangible for me to understand what I was looking for and what I needed. I needed a rider that would treat me the way you treated and cared for horses. I am a Christian and I was raised in a loving home. God has been in my life for as long as I can remember. And your story leading to the unfolding of mine brought me to a point of crisis. I realized that I was terrified of God. I discovered in my heart of hearts he was my abuser. And even though I'd lived my life pursuing a relationship with him, I didn't trust him. So I told him goodbye. I told him I didn't love him anymore. I told him I have nothing to offer you because I cannot fake a hope. I don't want to be a slave anymore. And just as I believed it was over, he rescued me. I don't know if you believe in God, but the character that you display proved he is real to me. He used your life and your story to help save mine, so thank you for sharing it. He has removed the garbage that the abusers and filth that the abusers and I myself have chosen to heap upon my head. He is taking the time to restore me, not kill me. He is slowly, gently, consistently loving me, even when I kick at him. So I wrote a book. It's for young readers, but it made my brother cry, and I'll be sure to send you a copy when it's published because it's dedicated to you. It's going to be a three-part series. First is the rescue, next will be based on the journey, which is where I'm at now, and then the finale. And oh, how I look forward to the finale and the total freedom that he offers to us where we are now. We don't have to wait for heaven. So there I am, on a journey.
That was amazing. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're right. I have a ton of questions.
Okay.
I'm sure you
do. We'll
definitely give you time. Oh, we'll definitely give you time to ask your questions, too. So I just want to start probably back more toward the beginning. You said you grew up in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. So talk about that. What was that like when you were little?
It was fun. We were super poor, but my mom and dad were really creative. And we always went on vacations. We camped. And then I had two little brothers. I'm the only girl in four generations. So G.I. Joe was my favorite toy, and soccer was my favorite game. And I wanted to just, it was a way that I could pound on boys. So that was how I grew up, just to my poor grandma. She was just so happy to have a girl, and I wasn't one.
You didn't live up to
no.
it?
No. Nope.
So. Did you hate dresses?
I absolutely hated dresses.
So is that why it's hard to be beautiful, like you said in your
part
of
it?
Maybe
know.
It started there?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, that's great. And so your parents, were they, did they read the word a lot with you? Or, you know, what did their faith look like to you as you were growing up?
Yeah, they, well, my dad was a fireman when I was little. That's what I remember the most. And then when I turned six, we moved to Dallas so that he could go to seminary, and because then he wanted to be a pastor. And so that's just kind of how I've been raised. And I've had some great conversations with Beau about just theology. And I was super, super blessed, I think, to be raised kind of with a non-denominational type of theology. It was a rude awakening when I grew up and started going to church on my own as an adult, because I didn't understand denominations and differences and what people, and I just thought we all went to church because we love Jesus and we like to hang out together. But wow, I was kind of like, whoa, it took me a while. So I was so thankful that they raised us that way, because I think it gave us a lot of freedom. And you know, and my mom got one of the best sense of humors, and my dad, you know, he definitely treated me like a princess, so I wasn't lacking in that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I know, and I'm sure you've met plenty of women who don't have that
right.
story, and it's, you know, I think it's maybe easy for us to go, okay, well, if you've had some funky sexual past, then it means your dad was a loser, you know,
right.
or something. And
right.
so I think that, that definitely can be the case, but you know, clearly
right.
the enemy goes after us no matter what.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how good of a job you're doing as a parent. You know, it can seep in whatever way it wants to, yeah. or whatever way it gets in.
Yeah.
yeah.
So talk about the seeping, you know, how did it begin, or how do you remember it beginning, or?
Yeah, I still don't remember. I don't remember how it began, and that's a definite tug of war that I play with God on a daily basis, and why won't you let me remember? Because it is really hard to go through the forgiveness process and all the books out there that tell you how to go through this and write this stuff out. I'm just going, okay, so I'll write out what I think or what I, whatever. But I just remember that at a super young age, I had a lot of demonic stuff happening when I was little. I had tons of night terrors, and I had tons of, I would see men standing in my bedroom, and I would just hide under my bed and hope that they wouldn't touch me or come in, you know, just they would leave me alone. But it was extremely evil. It was a very dark thing. So there was a lot of that was going on in my life. And then I was, like I said, I was an ultra achiever. So that's kind of where, as to the outside looking in, everybody sees this little model child, and the reason that I'm doing it was because I was so desperate for affirmation all the time. And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't because I was missing out on whether or not my parents loved me. I was missing out on, well, I was trying to figure out what was going on the inside. And so at least the outside stuff I could get rewarded for. So, yeah.
Sure, yeah. So you had this perfect little life going on.
Mm-hmm.
For my clarification, was it a dream that you would be hiding under bed, or you would kind of have this night terror vision and then you would literally go under the bed?
No, it was literal. Wow. Yeah.
Wow. So it was that real?
Yeah, it was that real.
Yeah. Yeah. Did your parents ever know about those dreams when you were little?
I don't remember talking to them about it. I don't. I had another weird, I used to sleepwalk. I mean, I undid alarms and went into people's backyards and got chickens. And so, yeah, I had a really interesting nightlife. So, yeah, there was.
How old were you when you can remember when those dreams kind of started happening?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Young, like 7, 6.
Yeah, super little.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, okay, so you were having some kind of turmoil going mm-hmm. on in your little brain, mm-hmm. and to kind of cope or whatnot, you then started to overachieve and
right.
be great.
Yep.
And what did that look like?
Oh, that looked like straight A's, every assignment that was given in class. I mean, school's so different now, but we'd get a worksheet, and I had to be done first turning it in. I was like the person that everybody wanted to smack. Because I would get up and strut, put it down there. It's like, it's all about me. and I had some mad crushes too. I remember in fourth grade, I was so obsessed with having somebody to like me, and I needed a boy to like me so badly. And as interesting as that is to be so young, but I'm watching my own boy go through that right now at 12. But just being so young and needing so much affirmation from a boy, a lot of it I never told my parents about, just how much I needed to make sure that the boys liked me. So I obviously got it wrong, because I beat them at everything, which probably wasn't the best thing to do, but I thought it would be cool. Yeah. So.
So how old did you say you were when you had your first like massive crush?
Fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about the transition, or like why then, if you were kind of terrified of men to some extent, were you then pursuing, why do you think, or whatever?
Let's see. I don't know that I was necessarily terrified of men. There were certain men that I just knew instantly that I didn't like. They gave me the eebie-jeebies. So pay attention to those, by the way, because that would be called instinct. I would always pursue the boys that would never give me the time of day. And so I never had a boyfriend. So that, it was just a real interesting tug of war that I had going on. yeah, there was just something intoxicating about being found beautiful. So.
Yeah. And maybe in a way that you could kind of control.
Right.
If there was, if there was some kind of desire.
If somebody liked me, no. Yeah. I had to like them first.
Manipulate. And, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So we're in fourth grade and we're interested in guys, but they're not interested in you or something like that. And you're manipulating and doing things and manipulating everyone kind of to, to have this persona.
Yes.
What was the next kind of memorable thing that the seeping in?
Junior high, going to, I went to Little Holloway Elementary, and then I went to Amphire Junior High, and it was just like, poof, there's just campus and almost like college, you know, to me as a kid, and nobody knew who I was, and I like I said in the letter, I literally had a moment of, oh, I'm done. There is no way I can keep up. There's no way. That person's better than me. That person's better than me. This person's better than me. I'm not gonna. And I shut down just immediately. I went completely down a path of just failing everything. No more sports, because I didn't want to come in second, for crying out loud. And then I quit playing the piano. I all of a sudden just started to believe that everything I did, I was doing because somebody was using me. They wanted something from me. And so I used, that was how I found control, is in holding everything back. So no, I'm not going to play the piano anymore. No, I'm not going to do sports anymore. No, I'm not going to do well in school anymore. Now what are you going to do with
me? I'm not going to please any of you.
Yeah, I'm done. So junior high was interesting. And junior high was terrifying. It was the first time I had a sleepover. And it was like I had a target on my head. I always had people, I always had guys a lot older than me always pursuing me. And I will never forget, I spent the night at a friend's house, and her brother, who was probably a senior in high school, had a friend over there, and they were asking me all these questions. And then, and of course, I was blown away that these older guys were talking to me and taking an interest in me. And then my friend said, well, my brother wants to know if you would scream or if you would just let him have sex with you tonight when we go to bed. And I just said, I guess I would just let him. And thank God nothing ever happened. But I remember thinking at that particular point, that was like the first defining moment where I thought, I have no idea how to take care of myself. And I thought, this is probably... I just remember thinking, and I know that this is going to sound really weird, but I almost felt rejected that he didn't pursue me that night. So,
yeah, it doesn't sound weird to me at all, and I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'm sure that some of the girls in here totally identify with that. You know, other than Satan, I don't know where that twisted thing comes from.
It's just confirmation of, see, you're unworthy.
Yeah. So. He didn't want to take advantage of you, like that's about, but we all, I mean, many of us think that way. Yeah. So you got out of the friend's house safe, I guess.
Told my dad, and he was like, what? Yeah, so.
So that, actually, I was wondering, did your parents talk with you about sex?
You know, I have asked them that question so many times, and they're like, well, of course. And I'm like, well, how come I don't remember? Honest to goodness, to this day, I can still say that I don't remember talking to them about it.
Yeah. Ever.
Ever.
So there was nothing birds and bees from parents.
I do not remember those birds or bees. Nope.
Did you get any education in school?
I created my own form of education.
Yeah, so exactly. There was no healthy education in your world. It was all, let me see what I can figure out.
Right. Well, okay, so here's one story, though. I was in sixth grade, and a bunch of us went to see a movie, and I had a crush on this little boy, and we went to see The Gods Must Be Crazy, of all things, and during the stupidest movie I've ever seen, this boy, I'd never kissed a boy, and he leans over and shoves his tongue in my mouth, and he has popcorn in his mouth, and... And so I'm sitting there going, okay, no, never again. And so it took me forever to ever want to kiss a person again. So as much as I wanted to be with boys, I was so mortified about the popcorn experience that I just like ran a lot of the time.
No thanks.
No, thank you. Yeah. So yeah, it was one of those that, no, I didn't like that one. So yeah. Very awkward.
Yeah.
Very awkward moment.
So you had no education.
No education.
You were confused and wanted attention, but only from those who didn't want to give it.
Yep.
You had a freaky question game happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? What was the next?
Oh, then we moved to Durango, Colorado. And yes, it's beautiful, but I swear it's covered by the most yucky cloud of oppression. And, you know, with my parents not really knowing where I was at emotionally, because I was still, you know, somewhat, it was just, you know, seventh grade was what it was, and eighth grade, my parents at that time actually were not doing well. My dad was really struggling with depression. And so we moved to Durango for him to pastor in a church up there. And we lived on the river, and it was amazing. So it was super fun to live there. But again, it was an older boy thing. And my dad has always been really involved in youth groups and youth ministry and stuff like that. And so he used to let the Young Life group come to our house. Well, I was just, you know, going into eighth grade, so I was still pretty young at the time. But there was all these beautiful high school boys there, and they were, you know, fun to hang out with. And, you know, and then they, of course, would say, gosh, you're really cool to be with, and, you know, we should hang out. And my dad had no idea any of that was going on. So it's hard for me not to be hyper-protective and keep my boys locked up. But so that kind of stuff started going on, and it was definitely with older guys all the time.
At this point, were you, like when you say hang out, were you kissing now?
No, I had still not kissed. I was still too afraid to kiss. And finally had this serious crush on this one boy. And of course, you know, it never ended well. And he and I never got physical with each other. But once I went on a Young Life trip, and I wasn't supposed to go because I was too young. It was a high school group of kids. But I went to Malibu. Has everybody gone to Malibu up in Canada? What's that?
Up in
Canada. Yeah. Other CA. It was absolutely gorgeous, but it was like it was a bus drive from Colorado to Canada, and then we took a ferry. And it's funny, when you mentioned camp, my stomach turned, because camp was where the worst things happened and where I did the worst things that I never thought that I was ever gonna do. I made out with a guy that I didn't know on a bus one night and did things. He had me ask me to do things that I'd never done, seen, thought of before, and all right there in a very public place. It was, of course, night, and everybody was supposed to be sleeping. But I didn't even know his name. And then the next day, he had a crush on another girl, and that was super fun. And I was kind of a mess from the beginning, so the whole rest of the experience at camp was to see if I could get a boy to like me. And that's how all of us girls were in the cabin. We were all just like, which boy do you like? And there was just, even the counselors were kind of a nightmare. It was really interesting seeing the men hitting on the women and how they were talking about each other. And there was not a lot of Jesus going on there. It was a lot of testosterone and things. So yeah, so that was the beginning of the end for me when it came to...
So how old were you then?
Eighth grade.
Camp? Okay, so that's still eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and then ninth grade. Sometimes I can't remember things very well. Sorry.
That's okay. So you went up to
ninth
Canada.
Grade. Oh, you're gonna forget ninth grade.
Oh, memory loss again. Huh?
Well, for ninth grade, I had the pleasure of going to Desert Christian the first year it was open, because we moved back. Durango didn't work out. And we moved back, and my dad was now my pastor and my Bible teacher at a school where there was 20 girls and 5 boys. And I would probably like to forget that entire year. I didn't have any boyfriends that year. It was just kind of like, there was just this drop off of there was, I partied a little bit, but I didn't, you know, there was just no real, you know, this is what I'm into anybody or anything like that. So it was kind of surreal being back in like the situation where there was a small enough group of people where I could compete again. So I was back to, this is about me. So
I do want to go back. So you went from grossed out about kissing, mm-hmm. To doing crazy things with a stranger, mm-hmm. To the girls in the room who are maybe at that stage right before the bus. Mm-hmm. What happened? How, you know, how did you go from one spot to the next? What would you say to save them from that?
Well, how much time do we have? I would say, do you know your worth? Do you believe in the value that you already possess? Because if you don't, I can't help you. Nobody can. You're going to have to make those choices, because if you don't believe in the value that you have, the other person already knows that. And I say that to you men too, because girls are just as good at manipulating a situation than a boy is. In fact, girls are becoming a lot more aggressive anyway. So again, I'm not going to lock them up, but I like to do a little routine with the kids. I'll pull out a $20 bill, and I wish I had it with me. Because, you know, when you hold up cash in front of somebody's face, especially if I was going to offer it to one of you, you'd be like, thank you. You can go buy something now. But I wad it up, and I throw it on the ground, and I stamp on it. And the kids are like, whoa, can I? I'll take it. I'll take the 20. I just want it the way it, I don't care. I like it like that. It's fine. And I'm just like, no, 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 and I'll just keep stamping on it, and I'll just keep wadding it up. And it's kind of a picture of, I did not have an ounce of personal value. I did not have, which is why I wrote, I sold myself for free. I didn't even believe that I was worth asking any money for when it came to being on the streets. So you have to really begin to believe and just start telling yourself it's not a self-help thing. It's a renewing of your mind on a regular basis that who you are is worth more than a $20 bill for sure, worth more than any monetary amount that can be placed in front of you, and that no matter what somebody does to you, no matter what lie has come at you, no matter how beautiful they tell you that you are, and if that you would just do this, then tomorrow would be so much better. When you unopen that, when you open it up, it's still $20 and it still has the same value. So it has everything to do with believing that. Because I tell you, I'm not a crazy, like, I don't make a spiritual deal out of everything, but I think that the way the enemy uses sex to destroy God's creation is his number one weapon.
Amen. So. We see that for sure. Mm-hmm. Believe that too. So let's go to the streets. You brought it up. So mm-hmm. We are in ninth grade and your dad's embarrassing you or something. I'm not sure. But
ninth grade was just a blah year, and then they just knew it was a really bad fit for me to be at that school with him still being a teacher there. It was causing a ton of pressure at home and conflict, and so I went to Saguaro, and at that point I kind of was reserved again in like trying to protect myself because I didn't like what happened in Durango, and but the crazy thing was, is honest to goodness, and I don't know how it is today in high school, but we had like different hallways, kind of like Napoleon Dynamite days, where one hallway was the stoner hallway, then we had the jock hallway, and then we had the nerd hallway, and I am not even kidding you, okay? Because like the people were dressed in that way and would hang out, and then, you know, you got the cheerleaders, and you got the athletes, and so I was such a chameleon, and I was so unsure of who I was that I would literally dress as a stoner one week, be a jock the next week, be a nerd the following week, whatever it was, because I still needed everybody to know me and to love me, and that I could be whatever anybody wanted me to be if that was going to be acceptable. So Carl, try keeping up with that, because I had a lot of different weird outfits, but I am very eclectic, I will tell you that. So anyway, that was weird, but I developed this really sweet relationship with a guy. I had a mad, mad crush on him, but absolutely nothing physical ever happened. He was just the sweetest, sweetest friend. And we used to ditch last period every day together, and we would run to these model homes that were being, you know, like a new development that was being built, and you can go through the model homes and check it out, and you just walk in and nobody knows that you're even there. And he and I would fantasize about, oh, this will be the master bedroom, and we would pretend that that's where we were going to live, and we would just joke around. And he was super popular and just so adorable. And so I got a little notice that I was failing English and I need to attend. And so he came up to me in the hallway and he's like, ready? And I said, I have to go to class today. And he tilted his head and he goes, really? I said, yes, I have to go. I'm gonna be in so much trouble. And he said, all right, see you later. And he shot himself in the parking lot about an hour later. So I had no idea that anything was going on. I had no idea that he was that desperate. And honestly, the note that he left was his hope was that his death would encourage people to stop being so horrible to each other, because he was bearing the burden of people bullying each other and hurting each other, and he couldn't take it anymore. And he hoped that that would stop it. And that sent me into a spiral downward, a nasty roller coaster ride that I ended up running away from home. And that was kind of my first taste in. I had a friend to live with, and it helped that she didn't like my dad, so she kept it a secret that I was living with her, because he was her Bible teacher too. And so I was living with her for a little bit, and that lasted for about 3 days, because we ended up hating each other. But she'd introduced me to some boys at Tucson High, and they were actually both older. One of them was an adult, and the other one was a senior in high school. And I was a sophomore, brand new sophomore. And so that was my first taste into, you know, I know that it's been a long time, but I still get shaky when I talk, sorry.
You're fine, and we love you.
Okay. So that was my first entrance into, again, I just decided that this boy likes me and I can live in his house, and it doesn't matter that I don't know him, and it doesn't matter that these other adult men are living here. He's expressed an interest in me, and I don't have to go home, and I can do what I want. So I'm in control, and it was perfectly normal. So people and police are like, well, why did you do that? And I'm like, because I wanted to. I was too restricted, and I needed to break free, or I don't even know what you would say. But so I was not the typical girl that got thrown in the trunk of a car and lived in a cage. I was totally willing to do what I was doing at that age. And so that guy was the guy that I got completely wasted for the first time in my life and lost my virginity to this boy. And that was when we started going to Nogales, and I didn't put two and two together till later, I mean like much later, years later, that what they were using me for. They were not trafficking me to for sex, but they were using the pretty white girl to get across the border so that the cops wouldn't look through their car for the drugs and stuff that they were smuggling back and forth. So, and all of that happened in a matter of 2 weeks. My whole life completely changed.
And you had no contact with your parents, mm-hmm, at this point? Did they? So they didn't know where you were?
No. Okay. Yeah, so I had been missing for 3 weeks. But the funny thing was, is I was here in Tucson, and I was just walking the streets. And that was how they ended up finding me. One of my friends' moms had known that I was gone, and she saw me walking down 22nd Street, and she pulled over and asked me how I was. I'm like, I'm fine. And she's like, okay, I'll see you later. And she kind of followed me to the house that I was at. So she called my dad. I didn't know she followed me, but she called my dad, and it was awesome. I got, I was in bed with this guy when, and my dad burst in the door, and with the police. And
was this guy the senior or the adult?
He was the senior.
The senior. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And except he was 19, so
an adult.
An adult. So I released hell on my dad. I don't think I knew that those words could come out of my mouth, and it blew my dad away because he thought that he was coming to rescue me, and he thought that he was coming to save me, and I was kicking and screaming. And so he did, and then he realized that there's all of these men standing there, and my dad was like, what the heck am I doing? Let's bring those cops in here, you know, or let's get, and so anyway, I went willingly, and nothing ever happened to those people. They never got questioned about anything. The whole case was closed as runaway teen returned to home. So, you know, and that's, in my mind's eye, that's exactly what it was, too. And then, like I described in the story, I was loaded on a plane and sent to a group home and performed for another year. So.
Yeah. So we don't have, we need lots more time, but I want to give the students time to ask questions,
sure.
too. So was that...
I got my grades up. I said what I needed to say in the counseling room. I rededicated myself to the Lord. I went to youth group. I was able to sneak out a few times, and I had some pretty intense sexual relationships with guys during that time, but never fully all the way, because it's the same, for whatever reason, I decided to tell everybody that I met from that point on that I was a virgin. It was something that I used as a way to, the only other word I can think of is probably medicate myself, was by lying about it. It made me okay to be losing my virginity again and again and again, instead of being what people said I was, which was a slut and a whore and stuff like that. So that time and living in that group home was just a time of faking to get out, to get home.
Yeah, and clearly you still live the double life,
which you
had mastered at that point, it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you came home, and what? You were
all hell broke loose. Oh. I lasted about 3 weeks, and then it was a free-for-all. It was so ugly. I was wasted all of the time. I slept with 4 to 5 guys a weekend, telling them the same story, and then if any of them expressed an interest, it was, you know, a threat. And
if they expressed an interest in you,
like if they called me later or can I get your number,
you would threaten them, or you felt like it was a threat?
No, I would threaten them with just see what happens if you try to call.
Yeah, you just wanted the one night.
Yeah. And at the time, I don't know that I could express it this way, but what I use it today as is just kind of like, because my life was so out of control, because I was being used, it was a coping mechanism to say, I am allowing this to happen. This is my choice, so I am in control. So this is not abuse. I am not being raped. I'm actually the one choosing you, and so you can't really hurt me.
Yeah. Manipulation and control, trying to protect yourself, mm-hmm. and in a distorted way.
Right.
You didn't know anything else. And at this point, your relationship with your folks was just...
Oh, it was wrong. Yeah, it was bad. I mean, they tried so hard to do whatever they could. It was really bad. It was just, there were bosses for places, at stores that I worked at. There was parties. There was a party everywhere to be found, and getting drunk was a way to remove myself from owning my behavior. It was really bad. And I'm trying to remember exactly what happened that ended up being the catalyst, but I know that there was an event where, my dad kind of laid the law down, and I just decided to play another card, and I bought a one-way ticket to Kansas City and flew to Kansas City and lived with a friend that I had met in the group home that I lived at. And it was a really bad situation, and that was when I actually really did end up on the streets. And when I say on the streets, it's more like party to party, house to house with people that you don't know. There were nights where I stood outside a bar until 2 o'clock in the morning hoping somebody would take me home, and nobody would, and so I would just wander. And that's the part of my story I share, I think, is the most devastating part of my life. That was one of the most humiliating moments. Was I was 17 years old. How many of you are 17 in this room? Okay. So I was 17 years old, and it's 20 degrees outside, and I am standing outside a bar, and I'm in a little tiny skirt and high heels and no jacket, and nobody looked at me. And at that point, it was just like, where? I am totally invisible, and I am. It was just that final blow, that final confirmation of, this is the rest of my life. I will go the rest of my life completely unnoticed and completely unloved and worth nothing. And it was humiliating. And because I'd tried so hard for 17 years to be noticed and to be acceptable and beautiful. So that was one of the worst nights of my life. So.
And how? I mean, we have to be done at 8, right? Mm-hmm. So we only have like ish. Okay. Mm-hmm. So was there any other memorable like thing before you start talking about where you're at now? Mm-hmm. Like, is there anything else that you want to mention? In the dirt.
In the dirt. Well, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot. That's not even Kansas City. I'll never go back. That was an interesting, what's so sad, and I can say this here, so I will. It just really bothers me that, do you know who invited me in all the time? We're people who were willing to sell me for sex. So I could get a job at a strip club, and I could get a job selling sex, but I couldn't get a job flipping burgers at McDonald's. I couldn't get a job working at what was cool at the time was the Limited. I couldn't, but it was like the people that I needed to come around me, I don't know if I probably would have bit their hand off at the time, but the people that I needed to fight for me wouldn't. And the people in the culture of using and abusing and money and sex, arms open wide. So if that doesn't mess with you and begin to shape and confirm what you believe about sex and the value of your body and the value and the fact that you don't have any value.
Except
to be sold, yeah.
So how did you meet Jesus? Where did that happen? I mean, we're in this pit. You have no value clearly in yourself, and people are using you. And where did he come in?
Well, He came in a little bit later. I mean, obviously, when I was a little girl, I was a Christian and you know, loved God. And then I was on a rampage against God, just thought he was the biggest, meanest, ugliest thing in the world, and told people that that's how I felt about him. And then, and I always preface this with, I never, ever promote premarital sex, nor do I promote a baby out of wedlock, but getting pregnant with my son was the turnaround for me, because he gave me a reason to live. And he gave me a reason to live because I just understood the value of his life. And it's so cool how that happened, because I couldn't see it in myself, but I could see it in this child. And so it was like, it was an absolute miracle. I was totally able to, I had no desire to drink, no desire to smoke, and I was just able to have this pregnancy, and I ended up marrying the dad because he was going to have a dad. I wasn't going to have this baby without a dad, and so there's a lot of history with that too. So Jesus entered back in when, or I let him back in, because he was always there, when I actually got pregnant with my second son, Hayden, and things in my marriage started going so horribly wrong. I mean, they'd been horribly wrong, but they got worse and worse, and it was just, he answered in a way that I can't describe to you, and it was miraculous. And I think one of the most beautiful things was, I was terrified I was going to lose Hayden because I'd had a couple of miscarriages. And I just remembered praying and crying on one night, because I just knew I was afraid. And I had the coolest dream where I looked down, and it was like an angel's hands came and touched my belly, and it illumined this beautiful blue light, and there was my baby, happy. And it was just kind of like this incredible moment that I knew I was having with the Lord. And it was just kind of like, I turned everything over at that point. And I had some incredible people surrounding me at that point, just devoting their lives to my life and to my children's lives. And then, because my parents were, at this time, they were in Washington, and I'm back here in Arizona. So he entered in an incredible way, and I had an amazing love affair with him after my husband left, during and after.
It sounds very intimate, that the Lord had seen everything, all the ways that you had been wrecked and ruined,
yeah,
and knew that you needed something totally personal.
Mm-hmm.
It may, you know, it wasn't maybe a sermon or, you know, just something. It was
right.
Just you and him, just as intimate as all the abuse had been.
Yep.
He needed to just meet you and speak,
yep,
directly to you.
Yeah. Yeah, we had an interesting conversation one day, because I thought I was all that, coming home from church with my two boys, and I don't need a man, and I've got two jobs, and I'm doing great, and I felt so fabulous. And then God said, you're dying and you're taking your children with you. And it was so clear while I was driving that I pulled over, and my son looked at me and goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm just trying to figure out what God just told me. And I said, what do I do? And it was, sell everything you have and move up to live with your parents. Okay, so I went home, called my mom and dad 2 weeks later. I was living in Washington with my parents. I rededicated my life to them as a 24-year-old woman and came back under their authority from what I'd left at 14. And that was an incredible opportunity for me to see the power of the Lord's blessing and the power of his plan for marriage and the power of the way that he takes care of those, of the fatherless. And it was an unbelievable opportunity. And I mean, I know that I'm asking a lot of anybody who's looking to go to college and get away from their parents to go back, but considering, if you want to learn from my mistakes and not go down the road that I went down, that accountability to somebody who loves you so much, and can have that, just seeking that blessing from your parents or from somebody who's in authority over you, God will knock your socks off. He will totally blow you away. And I wish I could have, I wanted to bring my husband with me tonight, because he's such an incredible result of God's blessing.
That's awesome. That's really beautiful. The last thing I guess I thought of was, I was listening to something today that was talking about how this distorted world of sex that we live in seeks to ruin this beautiful picture of submission mm-hmm. to authority.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we've had some fun conversations about that, didn't we? yeah. I forgot, I mean, one of the parts of the story with the memory loss, the reason that I found out about the abuse was when, right before I was getting ready to move in to live with my parents, I was still here in Tucson, and I got a phone call that my uncle had been arrested for indecent exposure, and it meant that he was painting his house completely naked on the outside of the house, so something was a little off there, and the neighbors didn't appreciate it. So, but it was interesting, because when I got the phone call, I was like, it's about time, and everybody kind of looked at me, and I'm just like, okay, I mean, I had so, and it wasn't just him, it was with my grandfather and another uncle, that the way that they breathe, the smell of their breath, and it still creeps me out today, just things, I had those EBGBs again, you know, about. And my parents were kind of like, well, your uncle abused you. And I was like,
wait, what?
They're like, wait, honey, you don't remember that? And I'm like, no. You want to expand? And so it turns out that my uncle had been a sexual predator, and he'd been preying on little girls for years, and he started with me. And he had, when they had arrested him and were interrogating him and all of that, there was a massive amount of child pornography found in his home, and so again, my counselor always tell me, just believe it. but you know, it's really hard for me to say that I know that it was my grandpa, and I know that it was my other uncle as well, simply because of some certain scenes that I have in my head. But they're literally just like an image of like a wall, but what it does to me physically. But my grandpa was in World War II, and that's when Playboy started like sweeping the nation, and all the pinup girls and these soldiers away from home for years, guys. I mean, they left their families for a long time, and so they found solace in their pinup girls. And my grandpa thought that that was so cool that he gave all of his boys, and he had four of them, a Playboy when they turned 10 as a rite of passage. And so it's a miracle that my dad came out the way that he did. He has a good story to tell about that, but that distortion of women and the value of women and what their bodies are for, and all of that was definitely deeply disturbed in me when I was really young. So it definitely played a huge role.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see the redemption of the Lord bringing you back under your parents mm-hmm. and starting over, like you said, yeah. going back to 14, maybe even going back to 4 or whatnot, and redoing, learning this is what a godly marriage looks like,
right.
and this is what love looks like,
yep.
and being able to be free to submit under godly authority,
mm-hmm.
and what a beautiful thing that was,
yeah.
in your healing.
You know, and I do want to say, for anybody who has suffered any kind of abuse, it's okay to tell God that you think it's his fault, because there's so much sex in the Bible, and it's pure and it's good. And then there's so much yucky stuff. My 18-year-old came out, because we got him this really cool Bible for Christmas, and he's like, okay, Genesis is disgusting. And I was like, yeah.
You guys know that, right?
And I'm like, yeah. Daisy goes, I don't think I want to read this. And I'm like, just, you're all right, whatever. Yeah, it is. There's some crazy stuff. And I'm going to be brutally honest with you guys. There were times when I was reading parts of Genesis just when I was going through the Bible, and I was having some really interesting physical responses to the most abusive sexual parts of the Bible, and it scared the crap out of me, because I thought I was really screwed up. And thankfully, I had somebody that I could talk to about that, and you know, and she was able to talk to me about that, and about the abuse and how abuse changes, you know, when you have pleasure mixed with sin and evil, and it's not a choice that you're making at the time, especially if you are the one being abused. But whatever words were spoken over me, and that's something I pray about a lot, that God would reveal that stuff still. You know, what was it that was spoken over me, and so that I can speak truth against those lies. But and I'll be brutally honest with you, I still struggle to this day. I have to keep my mind really clear. I have to be really careful what I see. I cannot watch chick flicks. They ruin me. So I watch, like, Rambo movies. because it can still be confusing. As much as I can be in the Word, I'm in the world, and it seems to be a lot louder sometimes. So.
Well, I could keep going and going and going, but I'm going to turn it over to you guys. What questions or thoughts do you guys have?
Here was I.
Oh. Tom.
Okay, so I'm 42. I would have been.
No, I'm a lot older than you are. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But my second question, I guess, is something you touched on a little bit, was your sons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that when I was in high school, and going to parties and in college and going to parties was the girls were some of the girls actually asked me, you know, said, hey, if you go in the next room with me, I'll make you a man, because I had, like, the naive thing on my
mind. Uh-huh.
But I hear from other students and friends of mine that are a lot younger than I am that it seems to be getting progressively worse.
Yeah.
And what are you doing with your sons that you're trying to protect them? Because with us guys, you know, when women are coming on to us, I think it's a lot more difficult for us to say no. I have two daughters, so, but what do you say to your sons, or what are you teaching them that to protect them from that, you know, that's what I see is kind of like almost like a turnaround.
Yeah.
To where the guys would go out, you know, manipulate the girls, but now it's almost even, or and the girls are now playing the same game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I did early on was I truly let my boys be boys. We blew things up. We fired a lot of guns. We put tons of holes in walls just playing. And don't get me wrong, I am still feminine, but I had an innate need for my boys to be boys, and I wanted to empower them that way. But along with that, I told them how to be my husband and I taught them how to be warriors and how to be men, and what the amazing gift that they were as providers, as protectors. We put those weapons in their hands and taught them how to use them in a way that would make them a man before a woman did, you know. And but my husband would also speak to them about, like, times when he was little. He kissed his first girl in kindergarten, and I'm just like, you're pathetic. He had the biggest crushes, and just, you know, and he still talks about it with a grin on in his face, and I'm like, well, I'm glad we don't know her or where she's at anymore, but no. But you know, it was a sweet thing for him, but he has a story too. We all have stories. So yeah, and each one of my kids are very uniquely different. My oldest is married to the most amazingly beautiful girl, and my oldest was introduced to hardcore porn at 4 by his dad, and I thought he was done. I mean, I was devastated, and I just was weeping on the way home one day because Skylar verbally told me what he saw because he needed to get it out. And I was just blown away that he was able to articulate at 4, and I was a little terrified that he was able to articulate at 4 what he saw. And God just, like, said, don't you think that I have the power to heal his mind? And I was like, then I am claiming that for this child. And he definitely went through, you know, his thing with kids, you know, the whole texting, sexting, the pictures that were coming. See, I wasn't ever going to get him a phone until he started driving. I know, horrible mother. But his dad got him one when he turned 12, his biological dad. And it was a battle that I had to set boundaries to, but there was no way I could actually monitor everything all the time. And so, and I'm also like, if you're going to fail, I'd like you to fail now while you're at home with us instead of when you're in your 20s. And, you know, so.
And did you talk about sex?
Oh, heck yeah. Those poor boys. I was invited to speak in so many schools, and of course I was invited to speak in their school, and I'm like, I'm coming. Do you guys want to go to Costa Rica or something? Because I'll be at your school. But it was cool. Yeah.
How has your vulnerability toward your sons affected them? Like, are they?
My oldest, I'm his hero. My middle one wants me to stop. And my youngest one is just trying to take it all in. And it's simply because of different places that they have been and different things that they've gone through as a result. Because like my oldest was loved by his biological father, me, and his stepfather. My middle son was completely ignored and abandoned by his dad, totally. So he went looking for him, and then he blamed me for all of that. So my vulnerability became something for him to use as a target on me and use as a weapon to try to hurt me with. So, and it kind of makes them uncomfortable when I'm that vulnerable with them about stuff. But now, even though he just turned 18, it's turning around and he's asking me some good questions and we're having some good conversations. So, but he isn't, you know, he's got his own demons. So, yeah.
What else, guys?
Okay.
How does your husband treat you?
Yeah, in fact, we love doing marriage groups with people, and especially younger couples, like 20s. And one time when we were asked to describe the other person, I just basically, just what came out of my mouth was, okay, he is not my Jesus, but I would definitely wash his feet with my tears. And because that's, he is... Yeah. He is good. Yeah. So.
Anything else?
Yeah, I got something to say.
Bo's turn.
Ali's got something to say. First of all, it's cool having you here.
Thank you. Yeah. It's awesome to be here.
Why don't you guys
here.
Give her a hand? That was really good, and you were really vulnerable and open with us and everything like that.
I have more.
You know, we want to pray with you.
Thank you.
You know, for some of you that are here, there's a lot of people that maybe have been abused, and, you know, and I have a similar background in some ways to you. I have a lot of things that happened in my past, and some stuff I can't quite remember because I was so young, and I just remember those pictures and mm-hmm. things like that. You know, I always think of Isaiah 43:18. It's such a blessing passage to me. It says, forget the former things and don't dwell on the past. And I could never do that until, you know, I met Jesus and I fell in love with Jesus and my identity became different. You know, I didn't identify anymore with my father and with my mother in a sexual past and all their sensuality in the San Fernando Valley in the 1970s and 80s mm-hmm. and all that. I started identifying myself with Jesus. And when you start identifying yourself as a child of God, you start seeing your life different. You know, you just see things differently. You start seeing your own worth. You start seeing your value as a guy. And, you know, the hardest thing for me to hear tonight was just to remember my past and think of, you know, the shame that I have mm-hmm. because I was one of those guys. And, you know, and to hear you talk about it from your end, it's like, in a way, it's beautiful for me because it's always been... I've always wanted to know kind of what was going on in these girls' brains, you know? because we knew we were so manipulative and so abusive, and we couldn't, you know, you never can figure out, like, why do these chicks stay around? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I thank you myself. It's almost, you know, as you share, it's almost a beautiful closure in some areas of my own heart. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. different areas that make me go, man, I needed to hear that. You know, I never really heard that before. So I appreciate that just personally.
Yeah.
But for those that are here that, you know, don't have your identity in Jesus, it's easy. It's by giving your life to Jesus Christ, who gave his life for you. And it's a free gift. Some of you go, maybe I know Jesus, but I've never really given my life to Jesus Christ. But you can do that anytime. You can do that tonight. You can do that by just surrendering your life to Jesus. I mean, what a beautiful guy he is. That he came and he would die for you and he would die for me, and that he would take our sins and he would lay on a cross for us. And he would pay a price. And I mean, he thinks you're that worthy. You're worth that much. And, you know, coming from my background, that's a hardcore thing to grasp. That's tough to grasp, that you're worth all that. That someone would literally take a bullet in the brain, even when you don't like them. But it's beautiful, and it's love. And when you look at Jesus and you see his love, man, it's hard to say no to that thing, man. It's beautiful. There's nothing like it in this world. You will never, ever experience any other relationship in this world that will be like the relationship you can have with Jesus. Nothing. It's better than anything. And so you can receive Jesus, you know, tonight, you know. If you guys have questions about that, certainly come and talk to me. But why don't we all stand up? We're going to make a little room, and we're going to pray for